Welcome to EB5 Investment Voice, where attorney insights intersects with immigration investments. If you are a foreign investor, domestic fund manager, or enterprising entrepreneur and want to get the most out of the EB5 program, you have come to the right place. I'm Mark Deal, and I'll be your co-host on this journey. I'm joined by your host, Mona Shaw, and other attorneys at Mona Shaw & Associates, as well as immigration leaders from around the world. So let's get into EB5 Investment Voice.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to EB5 Investor Voice. It's good to have you, and we've got a great show for you today. Before we get too far into it, I want to bring on Mona so she can tell you, well, what the topic is.
Hi, Mark. How are you, everybody? Yes, welcome back to the show. Today's topic is, well, it might sound a little dry initially, but we have a lot of requests and a lot of questions on this area. So we thought it would be a good idea to have an entire podcast dedicated to business plans.
Hey, I love that topic.
Yeah, the business plans, everybody thinks they know what they're doing, and business plans are one area which get RFE'd and have the most issues. And quite frankly, many petitions get denied really because of business plans. So we are very grateful and happy today to have as one of our guests, Bernard Rojano. Hi, Bernard. How are you?
I'm doing fine, Mona. Thank you.
Well, Bernard, thank you for joining us today and talking with us about EB5 business plans. But before we get into it, could you give us a little bit of background on yourself?
Sure. My name is Bernard Rojano, and my background is in mergers and acquisitions. I started and founded Execute Business Solutions 8 years ago. We have been working in the development and business modeling, business plan writing for EB5 since I founded the firm, and we've worked on several hundred business plans, both for regional centers and also for direct investment. And so it's a small firm. There's four of us in the firm, and we are based in Houston, Texas.
Wow. Thank you. Thank you, Bernard. And one of the big things I did want to discuss, one of the issues I wanted to discuss today is the fact that there is such a difference between a business plan for a direct project and a business plan for a regional center project. And I'm glad that you have done so many of these so you know, we can have a good conversation here. How many inquiries do you think you get in relation to these type of issues?
You mean as far as requests for direct investment work?
Right.
Yeah, that's a great question. We're seeing a trend. You know, each year is different, each quarter is different, each month is different. But what we're noticing is last year, 2015, I would say that 30 to 35% of our workload was direct investment work. And that means our deliverables, which are typically the business plan.
Yeah, I think I would agree with that, that there has been a marked increase in direct, and not just entrepreneurial direct, but direct pooled, which really launches us straight into the next issue that, well, as you often work with developers as well, you often find that they say, oh, we have our own business plan. We've done our business plan. How would you state that business plans for EB5 are different from maybe a business plan that a developer would do for a bank loan?
You know, one of the biggest things is you have to develop an instinct, you know, for what the USCIS wants to see within the plan. Because as you know, Mona, the way that they adjudicate these petitions changes, and the agency changes, and the trends change in how the agency reviews the business plan. So if you're not in tune with that, you tend to not deal with those issues or address those points in a way that are going to be beneficial and likely to be approved.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So you can be the best business person. I mean, there's amazing business people. I've seen amazing business plans that have been provided to me to start our work, and they have lots of information, but they're not tailored to what the USCIS is looking for. And of course, you know, the most important is the job creation and the investment qualifying.
Right, right.
And it being tailored towards what they have to check off their list.
And I always find as well when people give me a business plan that the objective and stuff is it's not very clear. Many times there'll be a lot of verbiage, and you're looking through to say, well, what are you trying to say? What exactly is this business here? So I don't know if you actually have that same issue.
We do. So as you know, there is a lot of interest in real estate, brick and mortar investment, whether it's combined with an operating entity or not. You know, it tends to be a big sector of the industry that EB-5 participates in. And, you know, developing real estate and describing a real estate project and a business plan it's really a brochure, right? So the developer is trying to sell his project. And so it's really a PowerPoint presentation describing the amount of units and the type of development that it is and the uses for that development. And then maybe some performance of what he expects he'll sell it for, rent it for, whatever it may be. But yes, you're right. It doesn't describe operationally what this business is and who's involved and how does it run day to day. It is a brochure. And so, yes, we run across the same thing.
Yeah.
For operating businesses, I'd have to say that people are writing business plans to describe the way that they intend to operate the business. But they don't pay attention to some of the details that a reader and the flow of the document where a person that's maybe an adjudicator in this case would understand really what the business is about and what the goals and objectives are and the likelihood of the project reaching those goals and objectives.
Bernard, let me ask you this. It sounds, and thank you so much for describing the difference between an operational business plan and the marketing documents that sometimes you see to attract EB-5 investors. But you mentioned a couple times that the adjudicators are looking for something different. What specifically are they looking for in an EB-5 business plan that would be different than a business plan you would use to get a bank loan or a business plan that you would use for domestic venture capital? I realize there's matter of whole requirements. We don't need to go into all of those, but what are just a couple of key things that you think adjudicators are looking for that standard business plans miss out on?
Sure. Most people that read your business plan have gotten a chance to talk to you and you've been able to describe it outside of EB-5. This is, you know, if you and I were starting a business and we were seeking investment or going to place debt or whatever it may be, you get an audience, you get to talk to somebody. The USCIS is not going to talk to you. They're only looking at paper. So that's the way the system works. And so the best thing I could tell you is you have to prove they do not trust what's in that document. They don't trust it. You must have evidence of what's said, and the narratives within the document need to be supported with that evidence. So what you'll find in our work is we're very heavy on, not heavy, but we're very keyed on exhibits and the introduction of those exhibits to prove what it is we're saying within the business plan. That's very different than what you'll find in most business plan writing, you know, for other purposes. So I think that's the biggest difference is you have to prove what you say, and that's third-party verification of everything that's within the plan. You have to prove your basis, where you got your information, where it came from, and why you think it's going where you say it's going to go, you know, financially, operationally. And so you have to write it for somebody that's never going to have a conversation with you, and you will never have an opportunity to explain it to them.
Yeah.
And that's quite important.
That does sound like
a
challenge.
And if I could just jump in here.
It is. Yeah. It can be. I think we're pretty good at it after you know, you do it enough times. You know, you just get good at it. But I'm sounding egotistical, which I do have an ego, but that's
Well, as you said, you know, 8 years of doing this, and you have to do it in almost a vacuum because, as you said, unlike, you know, working with banks of what they're looking for, because they want to give you money, but they want to see some information. And, you know, working with domestic venture capital, they're going to ask you some questions and you can tailor it. But yeah, USCIS and we work with the adjudicators, they're going to look at it, you know, make their decision from there. You know, if you're lucky, you know, on a subpar document, maybe you get a request for evidence, but yeah, probably not. So I can see we're leaning on that experience of 8 years of doing all this, you know, what flies and what doesn't. But Mona, it sounds like you had a question for me.
No, there are just two issues. I just wanted to jump in here. There are two other issues that you look at when you're looking at business plans. One thing is who is your audience? If it's a business plan that you're doing for the bank, then yes, you're going to have all of these financial numbers and statistics. It would be completely different. Here, the audience is USCIS. And here, the idea behind this, even though it might be a wonderful business, you're still looking at immigration and we're looking at law. And there's the rules of evidence as well, which come into it. Meaning that if you're going to be putting down figures, and Bernard, you can, I'm sure you'd agree with me on this, you can't just pick figures out of a hat. You have to state, well, where did these figures come from? What is the credibility behind these figures? And many a time you have to actually make sure that you verify it and then you show where the verification is coming from.
Yes, absolutely. I'd have to agree with that. That's a great point. You have to point at that, at those bases. So again, the basis can be a narrative within the document itself, describing where the basis came from. You don't necessarily always have to have an exhibit to back something up. If it's crystal clear to the adjudicator or the reader where the basis came from or where the parameters are for, say, the cost per square foot of a condo unit in L.A., if you can point at it in your narrative and it's clear enough, then an exhibit is not needed. Although in redundancy with EB-5 and having more is better than having less. I've learned that. And you don't want to overwhelm the adjudicator with pounds and pounds and pounds of paper. You don't want to have fill within the document, meaning just trying to throw stuff at them because you'll confuse them. But it's better to give them more information than not give enough.
You know, we often get asked, what should be the typical size of a business plan? And our typical business plans are in our office when we've completed something, I would say on average about 100 pages. Do you agree, Bernard?
Yes, of course. What we try to do, and I try to work with our team about this, is you know, we try to make very complicated things simple. That's our goal.
That's great, yes.
Yeah, I mean, you know, because an adjudicator that's, you know, with all due respect, they may have a degree in arts, you know, and they're sitting in a cubicle in Washington, D.C. And I've met some of these guys. I've had an opportunity to talk to them. And, you know, they may not have an understanding of, say, energy, oil and gas. They've never dealt with anything quite like that. So you really have to speak in a language that they can clearly understand and make it as simple as possible. So 100 pages is not unusual. Yeah, I'd say our standard business plan could be, you know, if we do a really, really good job, we kind of keep it to, say, 60 to 80. And sometimes if it's a very complicated up, we've written things that have 150, 200 pages, unfortunately. But that's what it has taken to describe this, you know, a very complex business venture. So I guess my point is we try to keep it as short as at all possible, but not miss telling the story.
So it sounds like it's long enough to proactively answer the questions that the adjudicator is looking for to qualify the case, but not so long to put them to sleep or bury the important information that they want to prove the case. And I realize that a business plan, especially an EB-5 business plan, although it's a strong document and could stand on its own, it also leverages and references other documents. So when do those come into play? And specifically, since we're talking about entrepreneur visas, and direct EB-5 cases, when do those come into play, such as like a private placement memorandum? You know, when are those required and how do you reference that as well as other documents, say economic analysis for job creation, those sorts of things? Well, that's more regional centered.
Right.
So.
Well, actually, Mark, it's the other way around. It's the PPM which references the business plan. A business plan, PPMs could either have just reference the business plan in its entirety, or more often they just pick up the relevant parts of the business plan and put those directly into the PPM.
Well, that brings up an interesting point, because part of the business is to be funded, and how that funding is going to come in through EB-5, what a business plan for an EB-5 direct case reference at, and maybe not, you know, completely go over the points of the private placement memorandum, but perhaps key points of the offering document?
Yes, I think the way to look at this is the point that for business plans, you hear the matter of how all the time, but the biggest point about the matter of how is credibility. And a PPM has so much other stuff in it, you don't really have that chance. Whereas with a business plan, you have the opportunity to really bring forward the business and show how credible it is. And that credibility is really what USCIS is looking for.
I see. And so what you're saying is including elements of other documents could take away from that credibility, or I guess to Bernard's point, maybe make the business plan longer than it needs to be and kind of obscure, well, the requirements that you're trying to show?
Partially, but the point also is that within a PPM, there are risks factors, and anybody who's drafting a PPM has to verify all the details. So they rely heavily on the business plan writer. So if you don't have a good business plan writer, subsequently, other documents do suffer.
So, Bernard, we've explored EB-5 business plans, but I realize that there's multiple types of EB-5 cases and multiple types of EB-5 business plans. So, you know, what are some of the major differences in business plans for the direct entrepreneurs, pooled direct investments, and regional centers?
Sure, that's another great question. So what we have is, for a regional center business plan, We are typically engaged by the developer that's selling this security to multiple investors. And the way that the program works is those particular cases have, they involve an economist to prove the job creation economic impact of the project, whether it's the expenditures or the revenues that the project creates. And so what you'll find is that there'll be a document that's included or referred to in the business plan that describes how we're creating those jobs. And then, you know, the business plan is written to reflect a private placement memorandum and describe the capital stack and the funding mechanisms that are going to be in place to subscribe the investors, put them in the investment, and then the deployment of the capital and the timeline of the deployment of the capital and the flow of those funds. In contrast, there is the other business plan that we need to discuss, the direct investment entrepreneurial business plan. And Mona, can you tell us a little bit about what you see as far as direct business plans related to RELECT and the difference between them and regional center?
Well, I think the biggest thing, Bernard, is size. Obviously, with a regional center project, you're talking about capital stack and you're talking about alternative financing. Most of the time, especially for an entrepreneurial case, it's very minimal. And the size of the project is a big difference. And I don't know about you, but we are seeing some weird and wonderful industries. And there's a lot of explanations that we have to give relating to the industries. It's not all real estate as far as entrepreneurial cases. Direct pooled is a little different from the entrepreneurial case because now you're talking about several people coming in. And of course, there's going to be more job creation and there is going to possibly be alternative financing along with the direct pooled.
Yes. You know, what we've noticed with direct pool versus, let's say, an individual investor that comes in and opens up a restaurant, spends $1 million, opens up a restaurant, and he's going to hire 20 people and then 10 more in year two. You know, it's clear for us to explain that. When you have the pooled, we have to allocate the jobs and literally describe the job creation and then the participation of each investor and making sure that those jobs are allocated to those investors. So that's quite a bit of a difference. But yes, and on the pooled, you'll find some that, you know, we'll use or some sponsors, general partners, sponsors, managing directors of the entity that's the new job creating enterprise. Would be subscribing the investors through different methods. Sometimes it's just a straight up partnership agreement, as you've seen, and so we have to describe how that works. And then sometimes they do go ahead and draft a PPM and do a private placement for the remainder of the investors that are needed. Do you see that, Mona?
Yes, yes. And I think that the vast majority of problem areas that we see or that are out there in entrepreneurial cases, which cause RFEs as well as denials, and this, again, emanates from business plan documentation, too, is the corporate structure. And if the corporate structure is not correct and if the job descriptions are not correct, you're going to have USCIS bounce your case back. The job structure, it's the position, obviously, that you have to describe. How much detail would you expect to go into for maybe a pool direct, Bernard?
Well, quite a bit of detail when it relates to the jobs, because that's the focus of the adjudicator. Is he wants to clearly or she wants to clearly understand how the jobs will be created and the timeline, and of course, can those jobs? Because when you're describing this, the adjudicator is looking at, you know, they do not want to issue you. They don't want to approve 526s, right? They want to approve 829s.
Right.
It seems to me that they adjudicate with that in mind. And so what they're thinking is 2 to 2.5 to 3 to 4 years down the line. And are those jobs still going to be in place so that the investment qualifies? So it's really important to not only describe what kind of, you're right, it's the job description. How important is that? Well, is it credible that, say, you would have a CFO or a chief financial officer for a company that has $1 million in annual revenue? Maybe not, right? Because you can't pay that individual. Some of the RFEs we've seen, you know, there are some very astute adjudicators that look at the financials and look at the human resources personnel expense line in the performance and challenge that and say, okay, you say you have 20 employees and you say you're paying them $500,000 a year. If we divide that by the amount of employees that you have and the job and taking in consideration the type of job descriptions that you have, you can't pay minimum wages for that.
Exactly. Yes.
The biggest difference, again, on in direct versus regional centers, that you really have to watch and make sure that all your narratives and all your financials and what you're saying and your org charts and your job descriptions tie in, and challenge that from the developer, because sometimes they're making mistakes. It's not that they're trying to say, but they just make mistakes. They underestimate, or they don't make it clear. So our job is to make sure and help them make that clear and tie in all of those narratives and all of the financials.
Bernard, how much independent verification do you do? Does your company do?
Well, so we do pull industry reports. We do confirm the basis. We challenge the basis. We do a lot of verification. And, you know, we request, you know, sometimes when we look at a set of financials and the financials don't take a lot of line items and considerations, we know what's missing. So we bring in CPAs and accountants and other financial professionals to review the financials, help the client develop a better model that addresses the missing line items, and then get it accomplished. You know, sometimes we'll do some of that work ourselves. We prefer to bring people in with the expertise so that within the plan we can tell the USCIS that these people were engaged and involved, and that they have the expertise to review these types of things. And so that makes the plan more credible.
Mona, you see a lot of these business plans, obviously all the EB-5 cases that you deal with. You know, what are some of the problem areas with entrepreneur petitions, and how does a business plan help out with that?
Yeah, Mark, one of the biggest areas, one of the biggest problem areas that we have seen in entrepreneurial cases are people who have bought a business, because it's very common for an entrepreneur to go out and just spend $1.5 million or something and buy an existing business. Where the issue is here is that often they don't realize that they can't count the jobs which are already existing. Bernard, you must have done a few of these as well.
Absolutely. That's a great point, Mona. And we do see a lot of that with direct investment. And so the challenge there is you have to prove the basis, meaning where did the business start prior to the injection of capital, and then what is it that the entrepreneur is going to do to improve and or enhance the business practices, the amount of employees, and its ability to grow and generate more revenue. And then what we can't do is we can't count the employees that were already there. We can't count the level of revenue that was already there. We can only count what's improved, what's increased, and that delta.
Right.
That's what the USCIS wants to clearly see. And so, yes, it takes some expertise, and the investors misunderstand that. They think that I'm buying a business and it's already got 15 employees. I'm in, like, it's all good.
You know,
I have all the employees I need.
Well, we see this all the time. Yes.
Yeah, you need 25. Yes. You don't need 15. You need 25, 10 more.
Right. And it's not that easy to put a business plan together which clearly marks this. Because what I've seen, we often troubleshoot for other lawyers, and we've seen some denials and RFEs here. And they might actually have created new jobs, but they haven't articulated it very clearly in the business plan. And they haven't really shown a timeline of when the jobs were created. So, of course, USCIS then just get confused and consider all of the jobs as pre-existing.
Well, let me ask you this, because somebody can obviously write a business plan themselves, or perhaps hire a non-EB-5 professional. Perhaps somebody has written, you know, dozens or hundreds of business plans for banks or domestic venture capital, but not a lot of EB-5 experience. So what's the real risk of writing the business plan yourself, or using somebody that's not used to dealing with these EB-5 adjudicators for the business plan?
That's a great question. There's a lot of very smart business people. Obviously, these entrepreneurs have a history of being able to start new businesses, and they're good at startups, and they've obviously documented or memorialized, written a document, a business plan to describe their business in the past. The problem is, the number one thing we see is that they're busy running the business, and it's very hard for them to work on the business. And this is a function of working on the business, the description of it. And so, number one, they don't really typically have the time. Number two is, by the time they get the document done, it takes much longer. They know the business, so they describe it to themselves. They don't describe it through a third party. So that's why they're typically hard to read or to follow because they use acronyms and they use inside or comments or descriptions that people internally in a company would understand, but external people can't understand. Number one.
What about a CPA? What if they wanted to hire their CPA, somebody that's already doing their books, perhaps their accounting, perhaps even files their taxes, and that CPA also offers business plan writing solutions? Are there any risks with using your CPA to write a business plan specifically for an EB-5 petition?
Sure. Well, we have a lot of great friends that are CPAs, and CPAs are typically reactive. They file tax returns. They're historical people. That deal with historians. They don't deal, they do projections, but it's not what they do most of the time. And writing an EB-5 business plan, we're talking about the future and clearly explaining where this company is going and how it's going to get there. And also, they typically are not, they don't deal with having to prove what's within the document. They just assume that whoever reads the document is going to believe the basis of what they're writing. And with EB-5 business plans, you must include evidence that proves that what you're saying in the business plan is correct and it's real. So that's very important.
And of course, the assumptions.
Absolutely. You have to back up all the assumptions. And you have to back them up with industry data. You have to back them up with bases that an adjudicator is going to understand and they're going to be credible. And then, the risk is obviously denial and a very long RFE or a very frustrated immigration attorney trying to file this for you. In the end, the dollar spent and the investment in bringing in a professional that has done it before, that, like I said, has an instinct for what the USCIS is looking for, because that's what it takes. You must know the trends of adjudication and what the pet peeves are of the adjudicators or the agency, because it changes. They look for different things, and there's different changes, and we keep up with that. We see what they're looking for through RFEs. We see what they're looking for through dealing with multiple cases and learning from the attorneys that are involved in all these filings. And so that experience goes a long way.
Yeah, the bottom line is here, Mark, is that EB-5 is very nuanced, and it's a very specific area with a lot of little hidden details that a CPA or a non-EB-5 person wouldn't know. They really wouldn't even understand some of the issues relating to guarantees and the forbidden language, as we call it. It does make a difference. And then even if you're reviewing, because often people say, oh, here, just review this that my CPA has done or such and such a person's done, sometimes you might miss or something might slip past. When you've had something put together by an EB-5 professional, then you have that confidence from the very beginning that there are certain areas or there's certain terminology which you know he wouldn't have used.
Right. So the risk of hiring perhaps a business plan generalist or a CPA or doing it yourself would almost be like going to a general attorney or an immigration attorney that doesn't specialize in EB-5 to do your highly technical EB-5 case. Would you agree?
Yes, you could say that. You could say that.
Yeah, I thought you would agree since, that's what you and your firm does is EB-5 cases. Well, Bernard, Mona, thank you so much for diving into business plans and how they work with these entrepreneur cases.
Thank you for being with us today on EB-5 Investment Voice. The topics presented in this podcast is informational in nature and is not to be taken as specific legal advice. If you have questions on the topics presented in this episode or other investment immigration needs, please contact Mona Shaw & Associates. Mona and her attorney staff can be reached at mshawlaw.com. That's mshahlaw.com. Or call the office at 212-233-7473. Don't worry about trying to write all this down, as it's already embedded in your podcast player of choice. The contact information and other valuable resources can be found there. I'd again like to thank Bernard for joining Mona and myself and discussing with us EB-5 business plans and how they can strengthen or hurt an EB-5 petition. We have a special episode lined up for you next week. Make sure you don't miss it by subscribing to the podcast. While you're at it, leave us a rating on iTunes. If you really found this episode valuable, share it with someone else that could benefit from this information. Until then, I'll see you on the next episode of EB-5 Investment Voice.